Hey everyone, this is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome back to the Device Talks weekly podcast. We've got a great episode for you today, one that's a bit riddled with technical difficulties, but we worked through them all. Our main guest is Andrew Napier, Dr. Andrew Napier. He's a remarkable medtech startup CEO who will tell his story about how he started this company, IntoBlade. Has a very unusual origin story. He actually started out in healthcare as a combat medic in Afghanistan. Has quite a story to tell there. I talked to him back in September. When I did, I wasn't intending to run this around Veterans Day, but with Device Talks West taking up a lot of our time, it just sort of worked out that way, and I think it's fitting. Thank you to Andrew Napier for his service to our country and to all the veterans who are listening to this. Again, quite a story, not only of his time in the military, but after, and the inspiration that led him to start IntoBlade, which I think could be a really important company. So enjoy that conversation with Andrew Napier. Before that, of course, Chris Newmarker, the executive editor of Mass Device, We'll be giving the Newmarkers Newsmakers. So we'll have that for you. And within the Newsmakers, there's news about a company, Cortex, that was created by Ajax Health and acquired by Boston Scientific. I know a little bit of a spoiler there. But the news I wanted to share up front is that Duke Rolin, the founder of Ajax Health, will be an opening keynote at Device Talks Boston on April 30th at the Boston Convention and Exhibition Center. So happy to have Duke Rolin there to explain the Ajax story, to talk about sort of the build-to-buy model that he's exploring and the success he's had so far. So I hope you'll join us at Device Talks Boston. Again, you can go to boston.devicetalks.com. Registration is open, and you'll definitely qualify for our early bird rate. This would be early. We'd love to see you there, boston.devicetalks.com. Finally, and more immediate, we'll meet on Tuesday for our Device Talks Tuesday, brought to you by TE Connectivity. You can go to devicetalks.com to check out that discussion. TE always does a great job delivering a presentation filled with data and graphics and all the important insights that you need. So go to devicetalks.com to subscribe for that. It's free. You can watch it there at 4 o'clock, or you can watch it whenever it's convenient for you. And of course, you can ask questions either way. And we'll be employing our new chat box, which is a lot of fun and a great way for me to connect with folks in attendance. So thanks. Thanks for tuning into this podcast. I know you'll enjoy it. Hope to see you at Device Talks Boston. Hope to connect with you on our Device Talks Tuesday. So let's get this podcast started. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Newmarker, how are you, sir?
Doing well, Tom. Doing well.
Yeah, it's been a week.
Yeah,
it's been a week for sure. Yeah.
It's been, you know, it's Thursday. We're talking on Thursday, November 7th. And I mean, I don't know.
Thursday
it's
morning.
Been kind of a slow news week, November.
Yeah.
I mean, what, you're getting ready for Thanksgiving? Like, I better get a turkey ordered or something soon, you know, or something.
We'll talk about the weather. We've got
weather
here in Massachusetts. Any snow there in Minnesota? I know you had some a couple of weeks ago, but
snow's
going
gone.
On
right just now. Foggy. Just foggy, yeah. Foggy, you know, rain stuff, you know, but,
yeah.
But yes, we had the presidential election this weekend.
Well, it is what it is. We'll put our politics where they belong, which is not in the podcast. But, you know, I think anyone who knows us knows where we stand on things, and that's perfectly fine. But we welcome all comers here at Device Talks. And it's probably too soon. I mean, obviously, this is a newsmaker. It's not going to be one of our top five, but it's the big news of the week.
Totally.
And it's going to have an impact on medtech, I mean, for sure. I mean, you had an article this week. We'll see what kind of role he has, but RFK Jr., has you've had a headline says he wants to eliminate entire departments at FDA under Trump.
Yeah, that's an article by managing editor Jim Hammerand, and he's on news programs, saying that. We'll see what kind of role that RFK Jr. has in a Trump administration, but that'll be definitely. I'd say probably from my standpoint as editor in chief of Mass Device and Medical Design and Outsourcing and our life science sites here at WTWH Media. I mean, a big role in coming years is going to be like really watching, the changes that we're going to see in the FDA, which is, our industry's major regulator. So, we got somebody who could play a major role in a Trump administration, talking about, potentially eliminating whole departments there. Another interesting thing to mention is, when you think about Project 2025, which Trump and the campaign disavowed, it was written from some people who were associated with the past Trump administration.
It's the platform. It just is. Yeah. Let's go. Whether it happens or not, that's fine. But this is the plan going in.
The platform, I thought if you go to page 452 in it, it's online all over the place. But it talks about it definitely has more of a, it seems like it's more geared toward thinking about pharma's relationship with the FDA, but it still describes public-private partnerships at places like NIH and FDA as a thin veneer for corporatism, and that funding for those agencies must come directly from the government with robust congressional oversight. And that's an interesting proposal, especially considering that at the FDA, the regulation of medical devices is, at this point, is paid a lot for by fees from device companies. So, that could be a. Is there going to be a change in the way this is funded? I've been covering medtech for more than a decade, and I've seen this process as, when I was really starting to cover the industry, a lot of devices got approval in Europe first, and then they got FDA approval. And the kind of partnership between the FDA and the industry grew over those years. And at this point, a lot of stuff, a lot of new innovations are getting approved in the US first now, while Europe tightened its regulations. So, what kind of changes are going to happen at the FDA that's going to change, the way it works with the industry. So, there'll be a lot to watch, a lot to report.
Yeah.
Those are
direct impacts. And again, 2025 is a guideline. It's a mission statement, I guess. So, it's what they might want to happen. At least that group of people who were first part of the Trump campaign, then disavowed, and I think will be part of the administration going forward. How much they can really execute on. We'll see. I think the less direct impacts, but still direct impacts, will be, attempts to cut Medicaid funding for healthcare. I mean, that's going to reduce the healthcare spend. And I want to back up and say, we're talking about this from a medtech perspective, from a dollar perspective,
right,
from a business perspective. I understand, and I want to put forth first and foremost that when we talk about cutting funds for Medicaid or restricting access to treatments that are currently FDA approved and available, that people will be impacted first and foremost and most directly. They'll lose the healthcare, they'll lose the rights to care that they already have. That is the most pressing and most important and most critical change. So I'm not trying to put the needs of our industry above any of that, but we're an industry podcast. So just focusing. Having said that, and having stated the impact it will have on people, and again, this is MedTech is a people business and a patient business. Fewer people getting healthcare means fewer dollars being spent at hospitals. What that means for those hospitals, which are already cash strapped, I don't know. I mean, does it mean they obviously will have less dollars, fewer dollars to to spend? Will they have fewer patients? They'll likely have fewer patients in the hospital, so maybe that eases up some of the pressures that staff are under, or maybe it makes it even more high pressure because staff are actually still taking care of these people. And showing up in ERs for right. things, and they're so this is going to have an impact on healthcare for sure. There, on the business side, I mean, that the stock market responded well yesterday.
Yeah.
So the big companies will have more money to spend on M&A. That's probably good for some people. If I were an innovator, if I were a startup CEO looking to raise my first round of capital over the next 6 months, good luck. I mean, if I'm a venture capitalist in charge of money, are you, without knowing who's going to be leading the FDA, who's going to be responsible for setting policy,
right.
how are you really going to bet tens of millions of dollars on a venture that isn't absolutely proven? So I think we'll see a lot more money directed toward later stage startups. So it'll be interesting to see what John Norris's Q4 numbers look like in January.
Yeah.
And if I'm a private equity investor looking to buy up medical practices or other businesses, this is probably a good time for me to go do it. There's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of fear, and private equity folks can leverage that and get good deals. So it's going to.
I kind of remember, there was that line in the presidential debate where Trump said that he had a concept of a plan for the Affordable Care Act.
Oh yeah, so, you can talk about ACA.
What's are we going to see? I mean, especially as we talk right now. I mean, the Republicans have won control of the Senate. It's still up in the air, but I mean, they seem like they're on the way to winning control of the House. We're going to have a Republican Congress, Republican president. Are we going to see, are they going to go back? Are we going to do another something with the ACA, repeal the ACA or whatever? I mean, we're going to have to, we'll be back to that again, and this is all about, the healthcare system that the companies we cover are selling into. So, I mean, there will be a lot to cover, a lot to follow, and we're ready and up to giving you the latest news on what's going
Absolutely.
On over there. So
I guess the good news will be if your company, as always, creating a device that saves time and money, clearly can make a case, you'll be in high demand. If you're a late stage company looking to raise money and you have revenue and product, you're probably going to have an easier time as you usually do than a early stage company. And if you're at a big company, maybe the stock prices diminish some of the rifts that have been going on, the reduction in forces that have been going on that we've been seeing and you've been reporting about, the layoffs, I'm not sure if there's a direct correlation between stock price and rifts. I think rifts are kind of done as a matter of practice now at some places, just kind of an annual house cleaning, for lack of a better word.
One of the things I think behind those layoffs was that we've, had high interest rates as the Fed tried to get inflation under control. The Fed started cutting rates, so more money's coming. Is the Fed going to cut rates even more next year, especially if some of the policies that Trump has proposed could, such as tariffs, could have a inflationary impact? Could that push the Fed to do more of that rate cutting? Then I'm sure the president wouldn't, our incoming president, past and future president, wouldn't complain if they keep on cutting rates. So
no, and we've already seen tariffs in healthcare. I mean, the Biden administration did 6 months ago with the syringes and the hospital supplies and the masks. So don't know what the impact of that was necessarily, but so we'll see. So I should have said at the top, Chris Neumarker and I, we went to journalism at a time when the industry was dying, but we went in anyway. So we're not experts by any means. We're a couple of knuckleheads, but it's just it's an industry we love, and just a few quick thoughts. So don't want to dwell too much into the unknown, since again, we don't know what the administration will look like, what the priorities will be.
Big thing is big. This is huge news.
Oh, sure.
And it will affect the industry they're recovering, and we'll be following this. We'll be covering this. So, so stay tuned to Mass Device and in our Device Talks Weekly podcast here. We'll be talking about this for years to come, I'm sure.
Yep. And again, it'll be affecting patients as well. And we know that also.
Yes. But
we're focusing on the medical devices. All right, Chris Neumacher, yes. We do have some real medtech newsmakers, newsmakers to review.
Real medtech news, real newsmarkers, newsmakers. So number five on the list, we had Philips launched a trial of a peripheral artery disease treatment that combines two procedures into one. This is about this new laser device that combines these procedures into one. So they're looking at, the idea is to simplify, pad treatment. And, they have, Philips, had a quote in their news release from doctors in Louisiana who were working on this trial, who said that, the goal of this new trial that they're launching is to, the goal is to demonstrate that this combined approach can, optimize procedural efficiency, help with patient outcomes when, treating calcified lesions. So we'll watch out and see how that trial performs.
Very, very cool. It looks like a cool device. The picture is pretty neat. Danielle Kirsch wrote the article.
Yeah, senior editor Danielle Kirsch. The two technologies they're combining are laser-driven atherectomy to remove plaque and intravascular
lithotripsy.
Thank you.
Lithotripsy.
Boy, to modify or disrupt calcium deposits. So that was a tongue twister, but yes. So.
I had a conversation yesterday with Microbot Medical, which is developing an endovascular robotic system that is a really cool way of delivering guide wires and catheters into the peripheral arterial, the peripheral vascular area. So
very cool.
Just nothing related to Philips at all, but just was like, this would be cool to have a robot that could help you get down there in those hard to reach vessels. So, yeah. All right. Well, that's a very good number five. Good luck to Philips. Let's roll to number four.
Hey, number four on the list, we got Jim Hammerand had a story up just yesterday evening about a BCI developer Precision Neuroscience raising $93 million in a Series C round. This was the SEC filing they had about the money raise. Did say they were hoping to actually raise up to $150 million in this round, and said about 21 investors took part in this. This just comes just like a month after Precision Neuroscience had some positive results for like a pilot study of its layer 7 cortical interface. So, they're in the same, they're competing in the same space as Elon Musk's Neuralink, Hey, $93 million. That's a good amount of money. And we'll see what's next.
Interesting space. And I see they're based in New York, which is interesting because Synchron is in Brooklyn, I think. So New York's got a lot of these. But
yeah,
there's a picture of the Precision Neurosciences Layer 7 cortical interface on Jim's article. It's very, very, looks like a very thin yellow piece of tape. And Jim wrote it's that
like flexible electronics, yeah.
Precision Neuroscience says the film is 1/5 the thickness of a human hair.
Wow.
And was designed for a neurosurgeon to implant or retrieve the device without damaging brain tissue. And the implantation procedure, unlike that of Elon Musk's Neuralink, does not require a craniotomy. Instead, physicians place the device with a new minimally invasive micro-slit technique that uses a 400 micron wide incision in the skull.
Wow.
That's pretty cool.
That's
pretty cool. All right.
Having something that minimally invasive is...
With the brain?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably good, right?
Yeah. No, invasive and brain doesn't know. To keep that be careful with my brain.
Yeah, don't cut my brain. Yeah, all right. Good. What is number three on the Neumarkers newsmakers?
Number three on the list. We've got, this is another article from Danielle. Danielle's been writing some up this week. We got Integra Life Sciences. They've got a new CEO. It's
Mojeh Poul, I would say. Mojeh Poul.
Yeah.
Moja Pool.
Yeah, they announced that Moja Pool is going to be their new CEO. And Moja was, she's president of a 3M's healthcare business, so which has now been spun out as its own independent company. It's Solventum. But now she's landed now as in the corner office over at Integra Life Sciences, which is really cool too, because we still just have so few CEOs of our largest med tech companies are women. Mm-hmm. To see another woman at the helm of a large med tech company, that's great to see as well. So.
Absolutely, and Integra is a New Jersey based tissue regeneration neurological treatment technology company, and Moja Pool will succeed. It could be Jan DeWitt, we'll say, who will remain as president and CEO until January 6th, 2025. So, congratulations to Moja Pool, and we'll hope to have her on the podcast soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And Integra's executive chair described her as a seasoned global healthcare executive who's going to bring a wealth of knowledge and expertise in, business strategy and transformation, commercial excellence and leadership development. There's a lot of excitement over there over her, joining as the new CEO. So yeah, that'll be awesome to hear more from her.
Great. All right. Let's roll on to number two, Chris Neumacher. Another big news from a big company.
This is by, this is a Cub reporter on our site named Chris Neumacher. He wrote something about Boston Scientific getting another tuck-in acquisition in. So, and interesting too. It's an Ajax Health company.
Ducrolein.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that he's running.
We may have some news regarding Ducrolein in a couple of weeks. So stay tuned, everybody. But anyway. Continue with this newsmaker.
Yeah, so they got Ajax Health had one of its companies was Cortex. They've got their FDA cleared OptiMap system that guides physicians performing ablation procedures to treat AFib, and Boston Scientific is going to be buying Cortex. Financial terms not disclosed, but they're saying they're planning to get this deal done in the first half of next year.
So, and this kid, Neumacher, wrote, the OptiMap system uses a 64-electrode basket catheter, a proprietary algorithm to identify potential active AF sources, and the goal is to provide physicians with precise insights to efficiently deliver an individualized ablation strategy for a person with AFib. Lots going on in AFib, Chris Neumacher.
Yeah.
Lots going on in AFib.
I mean, there's a lot of excitement right now in AFib because of, increased use of pulsed field ablation, which holds a lot of promise to, have better outcomes with fewer complications versus the radio frequency ablation that's been used. And, Boston Scientific is definitely one of the big companies in that space with their FARAPULSE system. So,
Chris Neumacher, that has to be the only PFA news of the week, right? We can't possibly have two big newsmaker stories, can we?
Yeah, that's the only PFA related news. Yeah. No, there couldn't be. They're actually as we're talking on Thursday, our associate editor Sean Hooley just ran out some breaking news that is our number one newsmaker, which is that Johnson & Johnson has won an FDA nod for a PFA system, J&J MedTech's VARAPULSE system has now been FDA approved. So it's another entrant into the U.S. market with a PFA system on top of Boston Scientific and Medtronic. So competition is heating up.
Amazing. And hopefully we'll have Johnson & Johnson at a future device talks to talk about this. You had a quote from Jasmina Brooks, the president of electrophysiology, Johnson & Johnson MedTech. Just saying that they're excited to bring VARAPULSE to electrophysiologists and patients in the U.S. So, good stuff. All right.
Yeah. Well,
Chris Neumacher, big news outside of MedTech, big news inside of MedTech. It's been been a newsy kind of week. So, good job wrapping it all up.
Thanks. Hey, for all news MedTech, go to massdevice.com.
That's right. And follow Mass Device on in Device Talks on LinkedIn, of course. And follow course, Chris, I always say it at the end of the podcast, but you folks should connect with Chris and me on LinkedIn so you don't miss. Chris is always posting these stories up there, so you'll know Absolutely. The newsmakers before anybody else. You'll get them nearly fresh off the presses. So,
yep. Connect, follow me on LinkedIn, and I'll keep you up to date.
Fantastic. All right, Chris Neumarker, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Take care, man.
All right, now we'll begin the conversation I had with Andrew Napier. Once again, I don't think I covered this at the top. When I recorded this back in September, this has never happened to me before. The only time it happened, I lost internet during the conversation. Just lost everything. It was gone. So we actually did this interview in two parts. I think I edited it and stitched it together tightly enough. But if you notice a redundancy or two, that is why. So, but it does not diminish the story at all or the importance of IntoBlade. So I enjoy this conversation with Andrew Napier, Dr. Andrew Napier, CEO of IntoBlade.
Well, Andrew Napier, welcome to the podcast.
How's it going, Tom? How are you?
Going great. Excited to hear IntoBlade's story. You emailed me last night introducing yourself and your company, and it's one of those emails that frankly I read all the way through and was really wanted to hear more, which is why we're talking today, and I'm sure people will enjoy the conversation. We'll learn about IntoBlade in a moment, but let's learn about you first. You've got a unique path into medtech. What sort of steered you into this direction?
Yeah, thanks first and foremost, Tom, for having me on. I do appreciate it, especially the quick turnaround there. You know, we're looking at a time right now as a company kind of taking off, and that's why I wanted to reach out to you and have a conversation. You know, I think that looking back on things, I'm currently a board-certified ER physician. You know, my path, as you said, a little unique, like getting into med tech kind of goes back over a decade and a half ago. I served as a medic in the Army. Back in 2008, 2009, I spent about a little over a year in Afghanistan, southeastern Afghanistan, as a medic. You know, part of my experiences in that deployment put me in, you know, right on the front lines, and I got to see these sort of devices being used in real time. Mm-hmm. I got issued a lot of things. We kind of saw a lot of things get rolled out that shouldn't have been, in all with the best intentions, right? Always like the pathway to hell, right? That's where it's paved. I kind of saw those things play out in real time. Now I'm 19, 20 years old, but I'm seeing failures in real time watching these things. And one of these were with video laryngoscope. So this is mm-hmm. a device that's used to place a breathing tube into patients. So a big issue with this is that, you know, it's equipped with a camera on the tip of this device. It goes into someone's mouth. And as you can imagine, as with any sort of optics, you go into somewhere that's muddy, that's got a lot of water, blood, spit, vomit in this case, it's going to obscure that camera. The same as you see for like guys on the sideline at NFL taking pictures, right? They got to really protect that lens. Now, the same thing goes for these life-saving procedures. You know, we had a soldier that was within our battalion that got hit with a vehicle-borne IED. You know, he reached out from behind his vehicle and to fire upon a rapidly approaching vehicle that was laden with explosives. You know, with this, you know, he exposed himself. He saved everybody in the vehicle, but when it had gone off, it hit his face, it hit his neck. He had some just horrendous shrapnel wounds. Now, the medics in my battalion tried to place a breathing tube using one of the devices that we were issued, and they weren't able to. They kept getting blood all over the lens. They had to take the device out, wipe it off, and unfortunately, the soldier had succumbed to his wounds into the field of battle. So, you know, very young, I started like ideating on this and figuring out and thinking, you know, I looked at my car and I was like, hey, like there's a windshield wiper, there's a spray that's on that. Why mm-hmm. wouldn't this be on a device like that? And, you know, I thought someone else would come along and smarter than me and figure this out. And it didn't happen. I went through undergrad, I went through medical school. I saw the same failures over and over again. I got into residency as an emergency medicine physician in my intern year. You know, these are 80-100-hour weeks. And I was like, enough's enough. That's when I filed for my first patent.
All right. Well, I want to back up a little bit. How does one become a medic in the Army? Was that something you identified? Were you interested in medicine? Did you know you wanted to go to medical school at some point? Or what drew you there?
Not at all. I mean, I'm a fourth generation Army vet. Army brat. I was born on a military base, on an Army base. You know, I was always drawn into that sector, into that region. Mm-hmm. And actually, my first initial paperwork listed me as 11 Bravo, which is infantry. I told my mom, I was like, hey, I want to like carry this machine gun, like with any kid at 18. Like, you know, I saw Rambo. I wanted to be Rambo. and she started crying. And, you know, with that, she's a nurse. And, you know, with my father, he was an engineer in the Army. They sat me down, had a conversation with me and changed my mind. They was like, hey, like, you know, there's a lot of other positions, skills, you know, look to be a medic. So that's what kind of drew me into that.
Wow. How difficult is it to become a medic? What's the training involved and how do they wash out a certain percentage of them? Because it's just, I'm sure it requires a certain skill set, certain abilities.
Yeah, I think, you know, and looking back on that training, yeah, this is a, you know, we go through these sort of 20-week intervals plus, and including, that's not including rather, your pre-training. So you go through, getting basic training, which is like a 9-week phase, which you go mm-hmm. to a place like Fort Benning, which is where I was at. And, you know, we train up and we go to this advanced individual training, this AIT, that goes on for 20 plus weeks. You know, the retention there is decent. It's fair. A lot of folks though, they can't, you know, digest this of like where someone owns basically your life. It's 24/7, right? And you are, you know, under the thumb of big Army, right? So, and then for me, I loved it. I loved the structure. I thrived in it, and that's what kept me in.
Wow. So, and you obviously, you were awarded the Purple Heart and the Combat Medical Badge while in Afghanistan. So you clearly saw some stuff and thank you for your service there. Could you just give me you've been there, you've been in an ER. I think most of the people who are going to be listening to this are more familiar with the hospital setting than the battlefield setting.
Yeah.
What does it draw on the same part of your capabilities? I mean, you're there, someone's in front of you, they're hurting, you want to help them. Obviously the battlefield has a lot more danger and complications than the hospital, but yeah. Did you feel some sort of connection when you went into medicine?
100%. You know, and you know, you look at situations like that and you know, being in combat, you don't know how you're going to perform. You really don't. You know, people talk about that. People watch movies. They see things. They think they're going to be this courageous person. And you hope that you could rise to that occasion. You know, I'll say that, you know, my time in theater, you know, we engaged with the Taliban all the time. And, you know, this was not, I was not part of some like really cool, like secret squirrel, like group. This was not, you know, I was with the Iraq clearance platoon. And I kind of felt like one of those ducks at a carnival that was just getting shot at, you know, all the time. So we would go on these routes, the Taliban would just set these ambushes for us, and we would just hope and pray that everybody would make it back. It would be just fine. That usually happened. We usually, you know, were able to get the best of the Taliban. But, you know, again, like they're just setting traps for us all the time as we go and look for bombs and we find bad guys. You know, I'll say that in that situation, you know, you watch where people's characters kind of come through. And mm-hmm. there were times where folks just couldn't handle that heat. I noticed that for my own self that, again, I just kind of thrived in that situation. I enjoyed it. I liked being in that. And I felt that I had a clear head. That really gave me an idea about what I wanted to do with my life. Like whenever I got home, I was like, you know, hey, I made it this. I mean, I all the time was volunteering. I wanted to go out on these combat operations. I wanted to do everything. Can I translate that out into a job? And that's exactly what I found in the ER.
And I think your experience, sort of speak, you opened it up talking about the devices and when they didn't work properly. I would imagine as an entrepreneur, nothing focuses you more on ensuring your device works than having had that experience, both in the ER and the battlefield. Because if you're trying to help someone and the device just is not allowing you to do it for whatever reason, it just, I'm sure it's maddening. I'm
sure. For sure. And, you know, I don't know if I'm allowed to curse. I'm going to, yeah, sometimes like,
let it, so, let it fly okay. if you want
you
to.
Know, it's a, you know, as a soldier first, and that's what we always say in the military, you know, going and deploying, I want shit that works, right? And at the end of the day, like that's how I function. And if I get issued all this crap, these things that don't function, people suffer, people die, people get shot, people get maimed. That's what happens. You know, we see the same thing in the emergency department. You know, you get some people behind a desk that say, hey, we can save a couple of dollars by getting this piece of shit. Let's purchase it. Let's buy it. We'll save, you know, $30 this week. People suffer because of those choices, you know, and I got really bothered by that, you know, seeing that as a medic, and looking at sometimes there was those budgetary options and, that get issued and rolled out to folks that were actually boots on the ground, like people that needed those things to function. I saw the same exact thing in COVID. The same thing happened. Everybody's got their COVID stories. But, for me that, that was what really emboldened me. And like, to push things forward was like, enough's enough. Like, I'm out here risking my life. I need to be in control. I want that autonomy for folks like me to have an option to treat patients and not focus on, you know, how many pennies they're saving this week.
That's amazing. No, I think shit that works probably should be on everyone's wall of every medical device company. Make sure your shit works.
Yeah.
So you decided to go into medicine. So did you just always carry that experience from the battlefield, your frustration with that device? Did you know, like, I'm going to go to med school, but ultimately I'm going to become an entrepreneur? Or was it something that just kind of stuck with you and wouldn't leave until you decided to act on it?
I think more so the latter. When I got home, I mean, I was out on a combat mission, and I was home within 3 days. You know, I was out, you know, pulling people from vehicles, suspected bad guys. And in 3 days, like, I'm back in the States. And I, wow, that kind of, it warped me mentally. You know, I got home and didn't really know what to do with my time. I felt sort of abandoned, that, you know, you train, you get so far into this. I mean, I was 2 years plus training, being in combat, and then I'm just thrown out to the wind. I really just threw myself at books. I always read. I thank my mother for that, like, very young. I always read books. And I thought, hey, like, you know, I might as well do something with my time. I'll just go to school. And I was a medic, so I guess I'll just, you know, study medicine, I guess. You know, I just kind of fell into it. But it was the thought of, like, it kept bothering me. I kept a little journal in undergrad of, like, you know, ideas, like things I would just, like, you know, think about, write about. And a lot of those were just kind of sketches of, like, things that I think that could be improved upon. And that's really where those things started.
It's amazing. I mean, I think of your experience, it's like the ultimate Stanford biomedical experience, where they follow people around to see how medicine is delivered and see how patients are treated. And you've had a crash course in that. I'm not trying to be cute with the word. You've been on the front lines, literally, both in healthcare and in war. So, you're a doctor. You became a doctor.
Yeah.
You were doing ER medicine for how long, and what was that experience like? Did it sort of, again, give you what you needed professionally?
I don't think anything's going to give me what I need professionally. If I'm being honest, Tom, I think that I tasted wine, and that water's too thin, right? And I think that happened at a very early age. I always want more, you know, and I'm always looking for more. I think that in the ER, very interesting. You know, I went through in 2017 was when I started my residency. And this is, you know, of course, prior to COVID, and it concluded in 2020. And so I watched the same sort of things happen, the frontline battles, the same kind of shit happen all over again. They played out again. You know, there was this moment, you know, when I got injured, we were about a kilometer outside of my base. You know, we were calling in, we were, you know, being ambushed heavily. You know, we had our trucks that were going black on ammo, meaning they were running out of ammunition to fire back at the Taliban. So we called in for support. We called in for mortars. We called in for, which got denied from someone over in the US that thought, like, hey, that's not a good idea. Denied us smoke. They denied us of any maneuvering elements a kilometer outside of the base. And I, you know, honestly thought I was going to die. That's why, you know, when we thought about that, I could see the enemy. I could see them approaching our vehicle. And, like, at that moment, I thought that I was done. My vehicle was ambushed. It was attacked. You know, we get hit with an RPG. It knocked my ass out. I woke up in smoke. I didn't know where I was. A lot of me felt that I was, you know, living sort of a parallel life. I thought that I was dead. And then here I was, like, living. It kind of forked something in my brain, and that's where things just kind of changed for me. And I kind of went down that path of just, like, no, that's not how, like, the status quo will stay. I saw the same thing happen back in COVID, right? So we kicked off, I didn't have a mask. You know, we ran out of equipment to run, you know, for this virus. Now, at the time, everybody was afraid, everyone, right? And in the emergency department, you know, I can tell you what I saw anecdotally. You know, we were watching people, I was intubating people in the hallways, people were dying left and right. We were running out of space and some in our positions in the emergency department to put, you know, those that have passed. and we ran out of equipment. I was trying to source things from China myself. I was going on to Alibaba and like trying to find people to send gloves, to send masks, because we were all out. Now the administrators who weren't in the front line were coming down and checking on the department, seeing how efficacious we were with our treatments, as they were wearing full PPE. They were decked out like gowns and gloves and all those things that we didn't have access to.
Wow.
You know, I remember I found a paintball mask off of Amazon. And that was one of the COVID positive patients. I'm wearing this paintball mask and I'm holding my breath and I'm hoping that I just don't catch COVID. You know, this is like very early, you know, it's in like early 2020. And just praying, like, I don't take this virus home, infect my wife, infect my kid. I don't know at the time, there's a lot, right? And it really brought me back. It was like full circle of like, here we are. People deal with the same shit in many different industries, and it's happening in medicine.
Wow. Okay. I could understand how professionally, you know, that the water is going to be pretty thin, to your point. At what point did this idea come back to you? We can talk a bit more about Intablade. Did you decide to become a medtech entrepreneur? What was that transition like?
I mean, that was medical school. You know, when I saw the same failures happen within scopes and the video laryngoscope that I was speaking to, you know, I was, you know, watching as a med student another intubation in the emergency department, and you know, folks were taking this device again, like on the distal end, they've got a camera, they're going in. The same thing happened to us in Afghanistan. They can't get this good view. They literally take it out and they're wiping it on a blanket, like on, you know, on the patient's gurney, to go back in and like do it again. And I was like, this is crazy. Like, why on earth? And like, this is it. If you, you know, if you can't breathe, you die. Right. So like, why on earth are we not putting more emphasis, right, on a device like this? And like, we're just expecting practitioners to back things out and wipe them off on blankets. I don't know. So I thought that was an absurd thing. So that's really when it started. This is like early, you know, 2015. That's when the gears got going.
So what did this early process look like? Did you create designs? You mentioned you had patents. Mm-hmm. And thank you, by the way, for sharing your story about the injury. I didn't want to necessarily delve into it for the sake of the podcast, but
oh, of course,
certainly adds clarity to the story. Did you seek help and sort of where you go with a medical device design? I mean, how does one sort of come up with what's now the Intablade?
Well, you know, I describe like people just kind of own your time. They own you in training in the military. Training in medicine is the same deal. You know, the expectation, you know, we're putting in these 80-hour weeks. And that's if we're lucky. You know, a lot of the times we are kind of extending over because they can average those times out mm-hmm. as long as you don't exceed a certain period over a long window of time. So some weeks I'm working 120 hours, right? So like in the hospital, I'm owned. I'm loving it though. Like it that experience, that the time under tension, the same as like with weightlifting, same with anything, you have to get those repetitions in. So I am appreciative for that. You know, I think that, you know, for me, kind of backing out, you know, where I started, you know, I was actually sitting, I was waiting on an OB-GYN rotation. And that's when I first started writing the very first patent. I went to Google Scholar. I started reading all the patents for like similar devices. I was looking at the language and I just started writing my own patent. I wrote everything. It's a non-provisional patent from start to finish. I went through multiple edits in between like delivering babies. And I got to a point, you know, of like, hey, like, I think this is legitimate. Mm-hmm. I was making zero money. At the time I was living in Miami, you know, about 50,000 was the what I was making, you know, with a kid, and it's not enough. There was a program that Miami had put on that if you were under a certain level, like at the poverty line, you could submit for a patent for free. They would put you in touch with someone that would help you submit, you know, your work. So mm-hmm. I had taken that opportunity and I filed my first patent.
Wow. Okay. So talk then about let's take a moment and talk about the device itself. So I keep saying Intablade, that's the name of the company. Is it also the name of the device?
Correct.
Okay. Talk about the Intablade device. What makes it unique? What is it? What is the gold standard today, and how is Intablade different?
The gold standard it has now become video laryngoscopy, about using a device that has a camera on it to enable that user to pass a passive breathing tube. So,
what is the physician looking for through that camera? What are they seeing? Why do they need to see down the throat like that?
Yeah, it's a great question, because if kind of backing out, you know, whenever you go into someone's mouth and you try to find, you know, certain structures, right? You're looking for like the epiglottis, you're looking for the vocal cords. You know, it's very difficult to get a line of sight when you're looking down with the device in someone's mouth, and you have to kind of angulate yourself correctly and get in a good spot, and you can pass a breathing tube. Now that is if things are perfect, right? So everybody's different anatomically. What's great about having video is that, you know, it puts this in real time, that you're not having to, you know, contort yourself and put yourself in a weird position. You can kind of see those markers, and have help with folks that are in the room. It's very big for early practitioners, right? For someone to say, hey, like advance it like this, back that out, et cetera, et cetera. You know, with COVID, that also became a big thing about, as you would have to contort yourself with the old school method without video, you'd have to get right in someone's face. So people that were, you know, they were identifying that, you know, more exposure, more viral load from the virus was getting people a higher incidence of getting ill and the severity of that illness. So they switched over rapidly in 2020 back to using video laryngoscopy. And so, you know, with our device, it's a single use disposable device, and everything that you need to intubate is in a bag. So you buy it and you can plug it in to any sort of mobile device. This is like your tablet, your phone. We made some apps for that too. So, you know, there's not these massive monitors that are $18,000, all this proprietary crap. Everything you need to intubate is right there.
Yeah. All right. So this is where I lost the internet. Again, I tried to see if I could, sew the two interviews together. There's probably some repetition, but lots of great stuff in here. So I didn't want to cut anything. So part two, let's go. So Andrew, now let's get into the conversation about how you came to start IntuBlade. What was we covered this a bit, I think, in our earlier part of the conversation. But what was the moment that that you said that led you to say, "I need to do this. I want to start this company."
Yeah, I think that, you know, looking back on those times, I, you know, really in undergrad, I kept a little journal and I would write things and ideas, really to keep my mind off of like organic chemistry or physics, just really trying to like break that monotony of being in the library. And, you know, some of those were just kind of out there. And I kind of went back on those times of like, you know, when I was in the service, and yeah, I really went back to those events and when there were failures with our devices that we were issued. You know, I kept thinking more and more about this and thought and saw the folks that were creating devices, people that were involved. It was very segmented, very siloed. You know, I was looking into some of the big like medical device companies, how that was situated. And because I thought I wanted to be an engineer, you've got one person that's working on one thing, right? Then you've got another person that's working on the design. You've got this person that works on this and this and this, and they come together and make this, you know, awesome device. And I thought, you know, just from a high level, you know, it'd be very cool to kind of start from all the way from scratch, kind of go into this and see where this goes. You know, I got to thinking after drawing up a patent. That's really where I went into like to Google. I went on to the, you know, the whole like repository of patents, started downloading every patent I can get my hand on, anything that was related, and wrote my own patent. And that's when it really became, you know, came to fruition. This is maybe around like, you know, 2017, 2016, in that time frame, putting together that framework for the first patent. And that's what made me realize of like, wow, you know, I can actually do this. I can create this. And I have the blueprints right in front of me. You know, I bring in subject matter experts. I bring in the folks that help me build this ship, so to speak. And hate to sound like Noah there, but it's just one of those things. Like, you know, if I can put that together and I get all the folks lined up, I think I can actually make this happen and make a difference.
So did you have an interest in being a startup CEO? Was that always something you wanted to do, or is the mission here more the creation of this device?
Yeah, not at all. I never saw myself in this position. You know, I really thought that I could add some feedback, add some things in. And then I started learning about kind of that underbelly of what's going on. You know, there's some people make a career, and not to speak disparagingly of anyone, right? Some like within the academic center, there are some folks that live in that life. That's just what they do. They go from grant to grant. They kind of live off that sort of a government, I won't say assistance, that government money, right? So they get awarded a grant, they move on to the next project. And really that grant money ends up getting funded, not to what they're actually pitching and what they're actually going for, but for the next project. And they just keep going and going and going. you know, I thought that if I had this idea, I could hand this off to someone, help them just, you know, get things going. We started looking at that process, and I did not want to end up as one of those sort of like science fair projects. And that's what I kept seeing time and time again. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought about going to my you know, within my medical school, and having that kind of built out. There was a physician in that group that actually had a horror story with that, that had gone out and helped to create a device. Then intellectual property came up to be a question. And, you know, with you know, being allowed to use like a 3D printer at the medical school, that was the big thing of like, oh, like now we own that the rights to this. And he's like, hey, like you guys did, you know, I mean, I appreciate, you know, allowing me to work at, like in the workshop, but like I did everything from start to finish. And they wanted to have complete ownership of that. And So that's when I started to become, you know, very, just almost like a, you know, recluse. I just did not want to have this out, you know. So I bought my own 3D printer. I was doing all these things, you know, buying things off of eBay, Facebook Marketplace, just doing everything I can in off hours in my own time to create this. And that's what kind of just led to like, oh, let me hire this person and bring this person on. And then next thing I know, like I'm responsible for, you know, a team of 15 plus, and it's a company.
Wow. That's amazing. So talk about the product. We hit upon it a little bit earlier about how it's different from what's currently out there. But take us through it again. What are the differential or differentiating functions or capabilities of IntoBlade, and why do you see an opportunity for it to replace the gold standard?
Yeah, where we have intellectual property, we have three patents that have been issued, and this all orients around the ability for this device to clean the lens during intubation. So nothing else on the market has that ability. You know, I was watching just recently at a conference, you know, they had a big giant robotic machine that would help someone to intubate. You plug this stuff in and it puts you on a track, and it has AI. It does all these things to like find the vocal cords and XYZ. But it kind of asks, you kind of step back, and as a clinician, I look at this contraption. You know, it looks like a torture device, and I ask myself, I'm like, who? What's the pain point being solved here? Yeah, it's cool. It's awesome. They've raised millions and spent millions to make this thing. But you look at intubations, and some of the biggest failures are because of a lot of blood spit, vomit in the airway. Over 20 to 30% of the airways that you have, especially in the pre-hospital environment, upwards of 50%. And people have failures in the field, not because they need a robot to find where the vocal cords are. It's because they don't have the right tools in their hand, right? They can't suction. They can't clean off that lens in real time. They have to back it out, wipe it off. That spit, blood, vomit builds back up into the oral pharynx. They can't go back in and find that target. So that's where we're very different. You know, a lot of these sections too, you know, I come from a rural area within Kentucky. These institutions can't afford, these EMS groups cannot afford $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 monitors to plug in for a machine that should it's costing these manufacturers pennies to create, right? So, you know, we built out an app. So this plugs in by USB-C to any mobile device. We've got a free app that's available on the Google Play Store, on Apple. And you can be anywhere with anything and be able to intubate in real time with a video laryngoscope. You talked about gold standards. We looked at, you know, 2020 with COVID. Now video laryngoscopy has become the gold standard for intubations. We're no longer going with DL. We're no longer going with these different avenues that have been around for 100 of years.
What was DL?
We're taking the same direct laryngoscopy, like doing without a video, like assisted.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So having that camera on board, that's become standard of care. And I'm hoping to, of course, with this device, make it that accessible, not just to large academic institutions, but to those rural areas that I come from.
So is this something that's you're testing? Does it require clinical trials? How do you build a case for IntoBlade?
We are a Class 1 medical device, 510K exempt. We do not require those clinical studies, thankfully. Thankfully, that's, you know, to the investors as well. That's they're going down that road. We're actually registered with the FDA now. We just started selling, you know, as we speak. We just hit up a couple of large conferences. We've sold out all of our pre-orders. Everything that we had on hand is gone. We're getting in things rapidly now, but no clinical studies required from the get-go. That being said, you know, we do have a couple of things that we've got in the works. We are submitting for a CBER this next week, and yeah, there's quite a few clinical studies that we've got lined up actually to help support our case.
What is it? What are you submitting for? You said a simmer?
Yeah, we're doing the SBIR for an AFWERX grant in sorry, it's just like the military. It's just like
I hadn't heard it called simmer before. Yeah, I thought it was a device. I'm like, ooh, cool. Oh,
yeah. It just makes it sound way cooler than that whole process is. It makes my eyeballs bleed. They're doing the AFWERX grant, and it's really all focused around what we're doing with the software.
Yeah. So I understood the why you wouldn't need a clinical trial, and I didn't think you would, but I was building more toward how do you make a case for IntoBlade? It sounds like you're not having any trouble if you sold out of everything you had in inventory at the shows. So what sort of feedback are you getting from folks? How are you making the case, and what are you hearing back from folks who are making the purchase?
That sort of real-time feedback has just kind of validated our approach from day one, right? So when someone picks this up, a practitioner picks up our device, looks at this, has a mannequin, they're like, duh. Every single time we hear that, and that duh moment is exactly what I've gone after, as an inventor. It's like, I want that. You know, I remember like hearing about this in elementary school with luggage, right? With having the four wheels on the bottom and like for that to move, a duh moment. Someone picks up this device and they know exactly where this goes and exactly what this is supposed to do. And they're like, why did I not think of this? That's it. You know, we want to show these things, of course, like in clinical studies. I think that's going to, to help validate that. But it kind of raises up that question about that infamous study about the efficacy of a parachute versus jumping out of a plane without one, right? So it's one of those things that I want someone to look at this and just think, of course.
Mm-hmm. So talk a bit about again the device and the process of which you use to clear the camera. What is the energy that does that? And how long does the visibility remain? Because I imagine it probably just gets covered up again by whatever's down there.
Yeah, we were just sent in a video actually from the field from a user that had just gotten this device. And, what they had ended up doing was clearing out, the mouth within vomit with a patient that had, a bunch of vomit within the oral pharynx, had gone in. There was a little vomit bubble that popped and went right onto the screen of the camera. And we have a 10 ml syringe and the sort of saline syringe that people use to clear out IVs, that they use that to inject medications within IVs. That goes into the handle of the device. It's a lure lock. You twist in and use your thumb and you can press down on the plunger and clear off that lens in real time. I use the smallest amount of the smallest caliber of tubing I could get my hands on, because of, again, like going back into physics, going back into other algorithms, principles. I wanted that extremely small caliber of tubing there, so that whenever the user presses that, they get a very high output as far as that energy goes. Right, so a very small amount of fluid can clear off that lens rapidly. So, this is very interesting to get going back to that, the video that I had gotten from the field. Very cool to see that in real time. Someone, clears out that blood spit and vomit, still bubble pops up and just boom, that's it. They push the plunger down, then out, in real time, the field comes back into view. They don't have to back this out or wipe it off, and they place the breathing tube. And that's done instantaneously.
And the apps you created, do they just transmit the live feed? Do they do any recording? Does it require any sort of HIPAA compliance or anything like that that a Meditech related software might?
All great questions. The compliance is of course something that we always want to tiptoe around. As it stands now, we do have the ability to export videos. On the back end, this is something that we've actually gotten partnerships with a few large cloud providers, specifically AWS, and going into a very secure environment for a user to be able to store videos in the cloud. The reason that we wanted to have this available is that for folks to have a hyperlink to be able to link into their EMR, their electronic medical record, to have proof of capture. This is a show really to the practitioner that, hey, I got this tube. Here's the proof. With this, we've also rolled out a few different things in beta, and these things are not available to the public yet, but being able to use machine learning to truncate that video down, right? So the only thing that you're seeing is whenever that device goes into the mouth and whenever that breathing tube passes, the balloon goes past the vocal cords, and that would, clip off the beginning and the end. then also rolling out things in real time within that app to help guide that user, to show, you know, like a targeting system. Like we were able to take ML from mannequin videos, just doing mannequin after mannequin video and all these different scenarios, and show like, this is where the vocal cord should be. This is what it looks like. Have a targeting system so that a user can actually know where to guide that device and where to place that breathing tube.
Walk me through what happens with this procedure. I had a sense you inserted the blade, the interblade, and it created the passage you needed. You mentioned the mm-hmm. balloon. I didn't realize there was a balloon needed. So clearly I need a little more understanding of what this procedure is. So exactly what happens? Please walk me from start to finish. What is the procedure?
It's pretty simplistic. You know, it looks like a kind of a hockey stick. It goes into someone's mouth. And that's the laryngoscope. You hold that in your left hand. You pop that in, you get the view that you want. You try to differentiate, of course, like where the esophagus goes and where the trachea is, right? So you got these kind of like double barrel rings. So you find the one that's anterior on top. You take a breathing tube and you go in, right? And you get that field. So this just kind of opens up that passageway for you to select where that breathing tube should go. Because if you were just to go in blindly without a tube or without a laryngoscope, you wouldn't know. Is that hitting the esophagus? Is that you know, insufflating the stomach? Or is that actually going to the lungs? Like, is that air going where it needs to be? So the balloon that I was speaking to is at the tip of the breathing tube. So whenever that goes past the vocal cords, you inflate that balloon so it doesn't back out. So that breathing tube stays in place, so to speak, where it should be.
Interesting. And I'm sorry, going back to the video, the point of someone having that shot of the airway being established and this procedure being a success, that just to indicate like, look, we were able to achieve that, and that can be used for whatever reason. Why would that be necessary in the future? What could that be used for?
I'll say that as a ER physician, it's unfortunate. A lot of some of the cases that I get, folks that come in from the field, EMS has attempted to place a breathing tube. Sometimes mm-hmm. they're not able to. Sometimes they're using old school methods like the direct laryngoscopy, the DL I was speaking to earlier. You know, they couldn't visualize that what I was talking about, like where the trachea set, you know, where the esophagus sets, and sometimes they quote unquote like sink the tube into the stomach, right? So they go into the esophagus. So someone comes in and let's say they were in cardiac arrest and say they place a breathing tube, they've been just putting air into the stomach the whole time. Comes in, they're brain dead. That's done. They have no fighting chance. You know, that, you know, you look at these sort of, you know, raw, like post Ross, like whenever someone gets pulses back after a cardiac arrest, some of the rates they're abysmal. But we give people a fighting chance, CPR, right? That's the gold standard. That's where that sets. But I will say, and I know speaking with other clinicians anecdotally, without even having to dive into the literature, time and time again, I get folks like this that did not have a breathing tube placed, or they just put, you know, the mask over their face and just bagged them. I open the mouth up, I check inside, you know, there's food. There's a blood clot. There's things that have stopped that person from breathing. And if that would only have been checked at the time of injury or the time when they were intercepted by EMS, that person may be alive. So that kind of goes back to that question for me of like, you know, supraglottic airways that we got issued in Afghanistan that I see EMS that we're using a lot of. That's just a blind insertion. They just take something and they stick it in someone's mouth and they hope the air goes to where it should go. That takes away that fighting chance for that individual. You know, I it's just having those conversations with families, you know, pronouncing many people dead. It's one of those things that I take very personally.
I can understand that. So this does, just to kind of wrap up, I mean, this sounds like a device that is making an immediate impact. It must be very gratifying. Not to get ahead of ourselves or your plans, but where do you see this going? Is this your new mission, or do you have other ideas in that notebook that you're going to be exploring once this has become the new gold standard?
Yeah. The you know, you always chase the muse, right? It's just the ever elusive muse. And I think that for me, no, it's never going to stop. I you know, have things that I've been working on, things that I've mocked up. You know, I never thought that I would be in this position where I'm at today. And I'm extremely grateful for my team, extremely grateful for the people that have believed in us and the mission to allow us to get to this point. I think there's a lot of other things that are in the works for a lot of people. You know, where I see the long-term mission is that I just want to see at the end of the day, those people have a fighting chance. The folks that should have been intubated to have that breathing tube in place. And I hope our device is the one. If it's not ours, it's someone else's. If it's me just banging a pot and pan, just saying like, hey, we should be intubating more in the field, then whatever. I don't really care. At the end of the day, like that's helped people. That's helped our society. And that's what I stand by. I think that in the future, yeah, of course, I'm always thinking and tinkering with something.
Awesome. All right. Well, this is an impressive story. Thank you for sharing it and for being on the podcast.
I appreciate it, Tom. Thank you so much.
And that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks, a weekly podcast. Join us at Device Talks Boston. You'll hear from Duke Rolin. Join us on Tuesday at Device Talks Tuesdays. TE Connectivity will be talking about future-proofing the design and manufacturing of proximal shafts. Once again, very data-rich presentation. I know you'll enjoy it. Just go to devicetalks.com to register for that. Make sure you subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network so you don't miss a future episode of this or our other podcasts. We have many, many podcasts, many more are coming. Great stuff going to happen in 2024 and 2025. We're starting to look ahead to 2025, of course. And that's it. That's a wrap. I got nothing more for you. I hope you do join us at Device Talks Boston. And of course, tune in next week. Connect with me on LinkedIn. Please do. I said that in the middle, but connect with me on LinkedIn. Connect with Chris Newmarker on LinkedIn. Connect with Kayleen Brown on LinkedIn. It's been a long week. And check out our YouTube channel. It's packed with great videos, getting lots of views from folks. Very happy to be bringing you that particular type of content as well. So lots going on here at Device Talks. But thanks again for listening to this episode of the Device Talks weekly podcast. We'll start working on the next one for you. Take care, everybody.